This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, Western Michigan University student Mei Yi. She's the featured speaker for the 15th Annual Peace Service, sponsored by the Kalamazoo Interfaith Coalition for Peace and Justice. But first, Christopher Phillips says we have a moral obligation to study the liberal arts. The assistant professor of philosophy at Southern Utah University will make his case tonight at Western Michigan University. WMUK's Andy Robbins asked Phillips why he thinks much of higher education is too focused on training people to get specific jobs.
I think that part of the reason that we have a moral responsibility to study the liberal arts is because we have an obligation to one another and to ourselves. And the nature of these obligations are a little bit tricky, so I'll try to spell them out generally. The obligation we have to one another, I think, is actually twofold. One, we have an obligation to be functioning, literate, and intelligent, informed members of our democratic society. Insofar as we have that obligation, it's really important that we have the kinds of skills that a liberal arts education can develop. The ability to think critically, the ability to listen carefully to rival points of view, to understand and sift through seemingly disparate sources of information and evaluate them appropriately. This isn't my argument. This is Martha Nussbaum. Professor Nussbaum makes this argument in a recent book of hers. But I think that she's absolutely correct about that. I think that's part of the obligation we have to one another. I think that in addition to that, we have an obligation to study the liberal arts because the liberal arts facilitates the ability to listen more carefully, to be more empathetic, and to engage one another in a genuine dialogue rather than just kind of waiting for your turn to speak. And I think that's a particularly important skill that we especially need now.
The answer to this question may seem obvious, but when we say liberal arts, what do we mean?
That's a really important question, I think. When I think of the liberal arts, I think about it in terms of the classic Greek conception, a very broad-scale understanding of the way education ought to be. So this will include your science, technology, education, and mathematics, as well as humanities fields. The Greeks obviously didn't have social science, but we would include them as well. But we need to include music education in that as well, and some sort of physical education. And so it's a very broad sense in which I'm employing the term liberal arts. And we sort of look at it today, I think, in a more narrow sense. We tend to run it together with the humanities, maybe with the social sciences as well. But I think it needs to be much broader than that. And that's what I think is particularly important as well. We have the STEM push, obviously, today. It's really important.
Science, technology, engineering, and math.
Exactly, yes. And these are really important fields. There's no doubt that we would do well as a nation to be scientifically literate, to be mathematically and statistically literate. But it can't stop there. We also need to be humanistically literate. We need to be able to talk to one another and actually engage. And so I think that is part of why we need this broader sense of the liberal arts to return.
When my brother and I were growing up, my father was fond of noting that he thought that a person should go to college to, as he put it, become couth rather than to learn a trade. And by couth, he meant a functioning member of society. But even at the university level, we really, in more recent decades, really seem to have narrowed the focus. And a lot of students come here overtly to, as my father put it, learn a trade. What caused that change?
I'm not sure exactly that I can speak to the history of that shift. But I can say that early on in the history of the liberal arts, there was sort of a rift between two different approaches. One was the sort of more vocational approach, and people like John Dewey and even Ben Franklin thought what we need is a kind of general education that will prepare people for the job market. We need people to work and to do things. On the other hand, you have folks like Martha Nussbaum and W.E.B. Du Bois who argued, no, it's really not about that. It's about crafting a human and making someone who can be a functioning member of society beyond just a sort of plug-and-chug worker, someone who can go and make wages. And I think that this is another part of the paper that I'll be presenting on Thursday. I think that the focus on practicality is confused and somewhat dangerous. Obviously, given the realities of society, given social reality right now, people need to make money in order to survive. It's just kind of the way things are set up. But I think that we have this idea that somehow college should be mostly or purely vocational. And it's never been that way. This is a relatively recent thing. I want to say it really picked up steam in the 50s and up until now. And so, you know, in the history of universities, 60 years is not a terribly long time.
Since we go back several thousand years.
Exactly.
The push, though, to focus education on the practical, as you call it, doesn't just apply to universities. Here in Michigan, our state legislature is actively, and our governor, trying to actively promote the expansion of vocational education at, you know, the high school and community college level. And often they're heard to say, well, not everyone is meant to go to college. Is that cause for concern, do you think?
I don't think so. There are two ways of interpreting, I think, that claim. One claim is not everybody wants to go to college. Not everybody wants to go and study, as I would say in the sort of broad sense, the liberal arts. And that's okay. And I think that if we interpret them charitably as saying not everyone has to go to college in order to be a functioning member of society, in order to contribute, in order to make a living, I think that seems perfectly reasonable. Now, that being said, I do think that we have an obligation to better ourselves and to better one another through the kinds of skills that are developed in the liberal arts. I think that you can study the liberal arts not just at a university. I think it can be done in your spare time. Obviously, if you are working sort of a more traditional trade vocation, if you're a master welder, for example, you can go home and read literature. There's nothing stopping anyone from doing that. And so if we interpret the legislature as saying something along those lines, I think that's perfectly fine. Alternatively, if they're saying something like, we don't want everyone to go to college, or we don't want to make sure everyone has equal access to college, I think that's problematic.
One of the things that seems to be looming on the horizon is, you know, increasing automation, which initially was only taking a few jobs, but now they're saying over half the jobs that exist now could eventually be automated in the next few decades. If that becomes reality, then what is the function of the liberal arts in education if you're not going to have a job anyway?
Right. I think that's one of the really important questions. Automation has become one of the most significant challenges, I think, of our generation. And given the rapid pace at which technology is advancing, it's only going to get worse. And I think this is precisely where the liberal arts can come in and serve a really critical function. Just a few moments ago, I mentioned that the focus on practicality is confused, but I didn't really elaborate. I don't want to give away everything from the paper.
No spoilers.
But the short version is that depending on how we even understand what we mean when we say an education should be practical, we might mean vocational, we might mean it's aimed at some sort of tangible outcome. Depending on how we interpret that word, I think that we can make a case for the liberal arts being much more practical than even vocational work. And part of the reason for that is because, again, a broad-reaching liberal arts education where you're statistically literate, where you're scientifically literate, where you are well-versed in the humanities and the social sciences and all of these different things and seeing how they fit together opens up significantly more doors than a more narrow pre-professional training will. I think recently Mark Cuban said within 10 years, people will only want to hire humanities students. And part of the reason for this is precisely because there is no sort of narrowly prescribed path. When you're studying nursing, you're probably going to go into medicine. When you're studying philosophy or music or literature, it's not clear what you're going to do. And so as a result, you have to think very carefully about how to package the skills you possess and how to sort of work your way out of this problem. And that problem is sort of a microcosm of what you do on a daily basis when you're studying any of these different things. And so those are the kinds of skills that I think are really important that we get out of the liberal arts, that we get out of the humanities, and that make people much more attractive as we face this uncertain and ever-changing job market.
You said a little bit earlier that it's your belief that studying the liberal arts helps a person communicate and to have empathy for other people. At least on the political front, we seem to have a shortage of both of those characteristics. Why do you believe that studying the liberal arts addresses those two areas in particular?
That's a great question. I think that part of the reason, I'll say more specifically about philosophy, is because an important part of philosophy is addressing arguments. We want to look at what people have said, look at what they've written, and with philosophy, it being a discipline that's over 2,000 years old, it's often very difficult to work out what people are trying to do and say. And of course, one way that you can do this is you can kind of try to play the game where you go out and you say, well, look, I pointed out where this person went wrong. And that's an important skill to have. It's good to know when an argument goes wrong and when it's not compelling or when someone makes a mistake in their reasoning. But at the same time, a skill that I try to foster in my students is the ability to read people who have these seemingly crazy views and say, okay, wait, why would they have said that? We recognize that they're an otherwise intelligent person. Let's try and put ourselves in their shoes. And so I think if you can do that with a philosopher who's 2,000 years old and who wrote in a language, in a culture that is fundamentally different from anything you've ever experienced, then it should, I hope, translate over to the person who's sitting across the table from you in a political discussion or otherwise. And so I think that the explicit focus on facilitating empathetic reasoning, understanding why people would think the things that they do, and recognizing that we don't actually have all the answers are the kinds of sort of touchstones on which we can build empathy and we can build understanding in these difficult times.
Given the tailwind that's behind the more narrowly, practically focused kind of education currently, are you optimistic that, you know, we'll come around to have the back to the future to be the way education was originally conceived of being much broader?
Cautiously. I really hope so. I think that we see this trend in hiring practices. We see it at Google and at some of their programs. We see it with Mark Cuban. We see all of these sort of important figures saying maybe the practical approach is not the right one. Maybe we need people who are much more well-rounded and who have broader skills, who are not sort of narrowly prescribed. We want students to have the freedom to think about what to do with their education rather than being told, okay, you have this education, this is what you'll do now. So I hope that we can get that. This paper, this lecture is sort of an initial step in reaching out and trying to perhaps market ourselves a little bit more effectively than we have. And I think that's been one of the downfalls. Especially with philosophy, people just don't know what we do or what it is. And so when you think of an impractical or a frivolous thing, you think, well, philosophy.
Southern Utah University philosophy professor Christopher Phillips spoke with WMUK's Andy Robbins. Phillips will speak this evening as part of the 2017 Center for the Study of Ethics in Society lecture series at Western Michigan University. The presentation starts at 6 o'clock in room 213 at the Bernhardt Center. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The 15th annual Peace Service, sponsored by the Kalamazoo Interfaith Coalition for Peace and Justice, is being held on Sunday. This year's keynote speaker is a Western Michigan University student. Mei Yi will deliver a lecture titled A Jewish Voice for Peace and Justice. Mei, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So let's first of all give our audience a little bit of background on you. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Waterville, Maine.
Waterville, Maine. Okay. And how did you end up coming to Western Michigan University?
Well, I studied at the Interlochen Arts Academy for my final 2 years of high school. And long story short, that's kind of how I moved south.
And you're a piano major.
I am a piano performance major.
Now, you are of Chinese descent.
Correct.
Tell us the path to Judaism there. Is your family Jewish or did you convert somewhere along the way?
My father is Jewish, though I grew up in a secular home. My grandparents on my father's side were Nazi Holocaust survivors. So that creates a very interesting, I don't know, dynamic, I guess, in terms of my Judaism, because it's hard for a lot of people. People look at me in the streets and they're like, you're not Jewish. You know, I've experienced a lot of discrimination as a result. I've been rejected from entering synagogues. So exploring my Jewish roots has been a really fascinating process for me. I began after I graduated from the Interlochen Arts Academy. I took a gap year after that, spent a lot of time with a distant relative who was passing away, who had fled Nazi Germany as a young child and only in her retirement home was starting to go to Shabbat services. That 2012 to 2013 academic year that I started exploring my roots, and to me, it was meaningful because growing up, as you said, I look Chinese. So that's how I always identified growing up, because that's how, you know, my classmates saw me. And as young children, we respond to how other people look, I think, at first. So then I said, wait, but there's another part of me. I'm not just Chinese. I'm also Jewish. So yes, I did have a conversion, though it's not necessary or required with the Reform or Reconstructionist movements. But for me, because I grew up secular, it's something that I wanted to do. To me, it was, you know, just claiming these roots of mine in an official way.
How rare is it that you meet someone that checks all the boxes that you do, that someone who is Jewish but also of, say, Chinese descent or you know, Jews of color, I think, is a phrase that I've seen some places.
Yeah. Well, specifically to meet other Chinese Jews, for me, has been pretty rare, especially when the person is not adopted. I find that a lot of times you'll see, you know, an Asian Jew in a synagogue, but they'll be with, you know, stereotypically like white Jewish parents, and the child has been adopted into a Jewish family. I have yet to meet someone who is born of a Jewish parent and an Asian parent. In terms of Jews of color, there are quite a few, actually. I'm applying to rabbinical school, and within the next 2 weeks should be receiving a letter in the mail. And at the school that I've applied to, the majority of the student body are actually Jews of color. I think that there are two black Jews there who are studying to be rabbis. I know that there's another Asian student there, and it's just a really exciting place.
So what would you like to do as a rabbi?
Yeah. So I'm really interested and fascinated and really want to dig deep into some social justice work through a Jewish lens, through a Jewish perspective. And that kind of has influenced my transition from being a senior piano performance major and graduating to turning towards the rabbinate. I've been pretty distraught over the recent election results and current administration. And it's been, you know, it's been hard for me. And I've come to this place where I don't feel like, to me, music isn't going to cut it anymore. I feel like there's more that I can do. Some folks listening may recognize me as the organizer of the February 5th rally that happened in Bronson Park against Islamophobia and for Muslim immigrant and refugee rights. So I just feel like I have a lot to offer as an organizer. I feel like I have a lot of passion in me. I also feel like I'm the type of person that internalizes the pain and the oppression and the suffering and the marginalization that I see takes place in the world. And I really want to have my part in doing what I can to tackle that, especially as someone who has strikes against them under this new administration. I feel like it is my, you know, obligation personally and for everyone else to step up to the plate and do something and take some action and do some change. So, you know, adding to those strikes within a Jewish community, I think that's going to be really powerful, because within a Jewish community, I'm not ordinary, you know, just in terms of being a Jew of color, being raised secularly, having my father who's Jewish and not my mother, you know, so having all these strikes against me, A, under this new administration, and then B, under a Jewish framework, I'm really just interested in pushing boundaries, standing up for those people who don't have a community otherwise, because that's something I've experienced a lot in my life.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you mean by the idea of being a Jewish voice for peace and justice?
Yeah. So to begin with, this is kind of a play on words because I'm a member of an organization called Jewish Voice for Peace. And Jewish Voice for Peace is an organization that is really fighting for the rights of Palestinians and really doing a lot of work to end Israel's occupation of Palestine. So I think that's where this title comes from. That's where I come from. In my keynote on Sunday, I'm going to be talking about Palestine and how I, as a Jew, support Palestine and really feel strongly about ending the occupation, about standing up, about fighting for the rights of the Palestinian people.
Do you think that a two-state solution would be the best outcome in the Middle East?
I do. You know, it's sticky territory. It's really complicated, and it's not just a black and white one-state or two-state answer. There's going to need to be a lot of things that happen once we get there, but the short answer is yes, I do support a two-state solution.
Now, you went to Standing Rock to be part of the protest over the Dakota Access Pipeline, correct?
I did.
What was that like? Can you just tell us about what you observed there and how that informed what you want to do?
Yeah, Standing Rock was an experience unlike any other. It was incredibly powerful. The thing that I took away from Standing Rock is solidarity. When I was there, there were over 10,000 people there. I was there over the Thanksgiving break, so there was a lot of influx of people coming to join and support the cause. On Thanksgiving Day, I was standing on the front lines, you know, face to face pretty much with probably 100 or so armed police in riot gear. And I was scared at first. I was like, I've never done this kind of social activism work. You know, I'm just really throwing myself in the deep end, and I was scared. They were threatening, spraying their water cannons at us. And, you know, I marched down to the front lines with a bunch of other people, you know, with goggles on. I had a bicycle helmet if I needed it to stray from rubber bullets. But once I got there and once I was standing on the front lines for maybe 15 minutes or so, I felt very peaceful because that's the energy of the camp. The indigenous people of Standing Rock and at Standing Rock emphasized this is a peaceful and prayerful place. One of the most profound chants that I remember us chanting to the police officers were, "We have prayers, you have guns." And that was, you know, kind of that's the message of the camp that I get. We are a peaceful and prayerful place. And it was incredible to experience that solidarity, that peace, that prayer. And I hope to bring that sense of prayer that I learned at Standing Rock to the service on Sunday, as it is an interfaith religious service.
Do you then see some parallels between the Native Americans at Standing Rock, and everywhere else for that matter, and Palestinians?
I do. You know, the Palestinians and the indigenous people, the Native Americans at Standing Rock, are indigenous people fighting for land. I think that's the biggest parallel that we can see. You know, this is sticky territory. Not everyone's going to agree. But the Palestinians were pushed off of their land by Israelis, really by Jews, saying that this is our land. This is our promised land. So many Palestinians are living in settlements. We have many Native Americans in this country living on reservations. To me, that's a pretty clear parallel of the situations there. The brutality on both ends from the, you know, opposing sides' law force is pretty clear. At Standing Rock, you know, the week before I got there, there was the incident on the bridge where there were, you know, hundreds of people sprayed by tear gas, hit by rubber bullets, and so on. And I know two people who are severely wounded and still are. And I follow their stories on Facebook, and we see the same thing in Palestine. Of course, there are attacks happening both ways in Israel and Palestine, but within the settlements in Palestine, and just within that whole conflict, Israel is, you know, the powerful force there, and the Palestinians are the one being oppressed. And I feel like I saw that at Standing Rock, that the indigenous people are being oppressed. This is their land that we are settlers on. You know, to put it bluntly, I think it's really important that we recognize that and we recognize their rights, because we are living on indigenous land. Yes, of course, this happened hundreds of years ago, but it's pretty fascinating to be there and experience, you know, kind of the root of what's going on.
But I wonder if you also see some differences, because you did just mention there that there are attacks really on both sides in the Middle East, and frequently that we hear of, you know, acts of violence, often in Jerusalem and the places around, you know, in Israel and as well as in the West Bank, et cetera. And so I'm wondering if you see some differences in the Middle East compared to here, or maybe just chalk that up to the passage of time.
Sure. Of course, there are differences between the situation in the Middle East and the situation here at Standing Rock, though much of my focus in planning for this speech and doing a little bit of research for it has been focusing on the similarities. So I don't really feel well qualified to dive into the differences, but I definitely firmly believe that, yes, the situations are not identical. They have parallels and they have similarities, but they are not identical situations.
You are certainly not the only Jewish person that has criticisms of the Israeli government. You're certainly not the first interviewed on this station, for instance. At the same time, I could imagine some Jewish people recoiling a little bit and saying, you know, first of all, there are regular attacks in Israel carried out by Palestinians. Second of all, I look around this country and I see threats on Jewish community centers, vandalism in Jewish cemeteries. Why are the Israelis the ones right now that get singled out? I can imagine someone making that argument. What would be your response?
So are you asking me why I'm so passionate about Israel and Palestine and not about the hate crimes and anti-Semitism that's occurring on our
grounds? I guess I'm making a theoretical argument that someone who is Jewish and supporter of Israel might make, that, you know, they might feel a little under siege, you know, hearing criticism of Israel while these things are happening in the United States, and also because of the frequent violence that does happen in Israel.
I don't necessarily think that the hate crime that's occurring in our country is, you know, an attack on Israel. And this gets me to the whole thing about what is anti-Semitism and how do you define anti-Semitism. One thing that I would like to emphasize is that, you know, being critical of Israel is not being anti-Semitic. I am still proudly Jewish. I'm going to be a rabbi, for heaven's sake, you know? Like, so I think I really want to be clear about that. Two, being critical of Israel is not being anti-Semitic. I, you know, was... My school is in Philadelphia. That's where one of the, you know, major cemetery destructions happened recently. And, you know, my colleagues, my classmates at the school were all there cleaning up, helping. And many of my classmates there are members of Jewish Voice for Peace, are critical of the state of Israel. And this was the community that was out there. The rabbi who was first there and physically walked around the graveyard and counted that 539 tombstones were desecrated is on the Rabbinical Council of Jewish Voice for Peace. So yes, even those of us who are critical against Israel are on the front lines here in the United States fighting against the hate crime that is happening and taking place.
May Yi, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
May Yi is a Western Michigan University student. She will be the keynote speaker for Sunday's 15th Annual Peace Service, which is sponsored by the Kalamazoo Interfaith Coalition for Peace and Justice. You can find links with more information at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.